Case 22-3186, M&C Holdings Delaware Partnership et al. Versus Great American Insurance Company. Oral argument, 15 minutes per side. Mr. Celebrezzi for the appellant.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Bruce Celebrezzi and my co-counsel James Papakirk for Great American Insurance Company. I would like to reserve 3 minutes.
Great, thank you.
As Your Honors are aware, the sole question before this court is whether Millennium sustained a loss that can be indemnified under the commercial crime protection policy issued by Great American. The answer is no. Millennium did not sustain a loss as a result of the dishonest acts of its employee under the what the parties refer to as the legitimate travel agent method, which is the only set of transactions which is before this court on this appeal. So we ask the court to reverse the judgment of the district court and remand with instructions to enter judgment in favor of Great American. Because this is an insurance contract interpretation case, the court should start, of course, by reviewing the language of the policy. And the policy states that Great American will, quote, pay for loss covered by an insuring agreement of this policy that you sustain resulting directly from acts committed or events occurring at any time and discovered by you during the policy period, close quote. And one of the insuring agreements provides, quote, we will pay for loss resulting directly from dishonest acts committed by an employee, whether identified or not, acting alone or in collusion with others, with the manifest intent to cause you to sustain a loss and obtain an improper benefit to the employee.
Close quote. Ask a question? It's more of a hypothetical, but I'm trying to figure out how far your argument goes. So what if an employee, what if an employer had just like a safe with a whole bunch of money in it, and an employee broke in, stole the money, and then the employer calls a creditor and says, look, my employees took all this money, I really can't pay you. And then the creditor just was like, oh, I understand, okay. And I'll forgive half your debt. Under the terms of that, the plan and your argument, would they not have suffered a loss because the creditor forgave half the debt in light of the employee's impropriety?
Your Honor, under that hypothetical, I believe the answer would be that first, this is an indemnity policy, so they would have to pay. But if they were going to pay half of the debt, then that half would be a loss, I think, under Your Honor's hypothetical. But, of course, that is not what happened here.
So I didn't understand. Would your answer be that the insurer would have to pay the entire amount, or the insurer would only have to pay, would reduce the amount paid because of the creditor's good nature?
I think it's the latter. If this policy covers a loss, and loss is defined by the cases as an actual loss or a pecuniary loss.
So your argument seems pretty extreme. It just seems, what if they go into bankruptcy and they can't pay any debts? Then does that mean you don't have to pay at all because they don't have any money to pay anybody? So then they're not paying anybody, or?
No, I don't think that, Your Honor, that I'm saying.
Okay, so what's the limiting principle for why? Why we should look at collateral consequences of an employee's impropriety in order to determine the obligation of the insurer?
Because otherwise, we would have exactly the scenario that we would have here should the district court's judgment be affirmed, which is a huge windfall to the insured. Because the policy does not cover theft. It does not cover dishonest acts. It covers loss because of the dishonest acts. And all of the cases that we cite talk about that there has to be some sort of pecuniary loss or actual loss. And so if there is no actual loss, here the scenario was that they were always intending Millennium, under this legitimate travel agent method, to pay the travel agents that brought them the business.
But still, it's always the employer loss. It just has subsidiary effects. I mean, an employer loses money. They have less dividends now, so do the dividends not count? So if they have less dividends, the shareholders get less. So then the shareholders have suffered the loss, not the employer.
That is not what we have here at all. They did not suffer a pecuniary loss because they were always
they
going.
They suffered a pecuniary loss. It's just it was passed on to the agents who could have sued them, but the agents didn't for some reason, or at least it's not clear in the record why they didn't. The actual agents. But they suffered the loss. They now have a legal obligations to the legitimate agents that the legitimate agents could have collected via a lawsuit. And it just so happens that either they didn't or it's just not in the record whether they did.
Well, actually, the record here shows to the contrary, that they've never paid the legitimate
agents. Well, then they got out of why shouldn't they be able to get out of the liability? Why?
That means
they have suffered a loss. The agents, for some reason, have decided not to collect on a legal claim that they have due. So that means that the employer now has more money in its coffers because of either the negligence or the good-hearted nature of the agents. But so they have suffered the loss in that sense. They have more money because they didn't have to pay the actual agents.
Your Honor, this is a contract where the parties agreed to certain terms, and the parties agreed.
Yeah, we're all debating the meaning of the word loss.
Correct.
And I'm just saying that we should just look at the word loss about whether the money has been taken from the employer, and it seems like it has here. And it's just and now they owe other people money. And it's kind of like that's the point of my first hypothetical is your argument has no endpoint. And it seems quite strange to me to say if an employer just engages, employee just engages in outright theft, that you get to just look at what happens after that, and if they can somehow spread that loss with other people, that somehow reduces your liability, even though I would have thought everybody would agree that the employer suffered a loss when an employee broke into a safe and stole all of its money.
Your Honor, in fact, none of the cases adopt the position that Your Honor is purporting.
Well, I thought, like the Michigan case, our own cases adopt that view. What American Federation or whatever that case is called seems to adopt that view wholeheartedly.
No, Your Honor, those two cases, American Tooling and First Defiance, which the district court relied on and Millennium relies on, never addressed the issue of whether there was or was not a loss. In both of those cases, it was clear from the record that there was a loss. And in both of those cases, I should point out, the court did do exactly what we're saying Your Honor should be doing, is looking at the entire transaction. Millennium says, Mr. Mertes took the money, end of case. Those two cases, along with all the other cases we cited, did not stop there.
Did I misread American Tooling? It seemed like the court did address that the parties disputed whether there was a loss.
Your Honor. The both of those cases, the courts listed the three issues that they were going to address, and one of those issues that so happened in both cases was the meaning of the term direct loss.
Doesn't that assume there was a loss? There's a loss. We just want to know if there's a direct loss or not.
Well, correct.
There's no debating over whether there's a loss.
That's exactly our point, Your Honor. In those two cases, there was a loss.
We would obliterate that precedent because there was an embedded premise in the precedent that there was a loss, and the only question was whether it's direct. And your point now is that what they should have argued in that case is that there simply wasn't a loss.
No, not at all, Your Honor.
So you agree that there was a loss in that case?
Well, absolutely there was a loss in both of those cases, and those facts are completely different than what we have here. In American Tooling, they paid the money, the company in Michigan paid the money to the vendor in China, or was trying to do that.
They paid the money to some fraudulent.
Correct.
It never made it to the vendor in China.
Correct, but then, after that happened, and this is why we can't stop just on the moment of the theft, they ended up paying the vendor half of what they owed, and then they agreed to pay the second half pending the insurance claim. So there, and we've said that here, if Millennium had paid twice, if Millennium had paid Mertes, the thief, who didn't deserve the money.
How does this work, practically? So you're saying there's no loss because Millennium never had to pay the actual agents?
No, I'm saying there's no loss because Millennium ended up in exactly the same spot.
Okay, well, because they didn't pay the other agents.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, so you're saying exactly what you're just talking about. Let me get a little frustrated because you're saying that if Millennium benefits from the forbearance or negligence of the agents who should have been paid, then there's no loss. But if they do want to collect, then there is a loss. In other words, if someone, there's no loss here because they didn't actually end up having to pay that money. That's your point.
That's correct.
Okay, but so how does this work practically? Do we wait? Do we have to wait for like 4 years until the statute of limitations runs before we figure out whether there's a loss or not? I mean, there's like a lot of complicated practicalities of your theory. Like, this side's pretty straightforward. There was a loss. You're saying, no, we have to look at all these other factors and figure out down the road, was there an actual loss or not? And then 4 years later, when the limitations period runs or whatever it is, we'll say, oh, okay, there was a loss, there wasn't.
Well, and Great American, and this is in the record at page 154, always has told Millennium that in the event that they have to pay these legitimate travel agents, then Great American...
Well, the other way it could have been done is a callback. We'll pay you because it's a loss, and if you get that money back, you have an obligation to tell us, and you'll pay us back like a clawbacker.
Well, because it's a policy of indemnity, Your Honor. It's not a liability policy.
No, but couldn't you have included that language in there? We'll indemnify you, but if it turns out later on that you didn't need that indemnification, you'll pay us back.
How would that ever be enforced? That seems to be impossible.
Okay, well, I'm asking you about a thing that situation seems awfully difficult to enforce, too, which is there's all these contingencies down the road. It could be longer than, it could be limitations period. If an agent comes forward 10 years later, how long do we have to wait until we figure out whether there's a loss here under your theory?
I can't answer your question as asked because those are not remotely the facts here. The facts here is...
Well, what are the facts? And this your theory always turns on some other party, not the party with the indemnification in the company, but some other parties, their actions and what they do, and whether that ultimately results in a loss to the insured.
Well, that is not that could be accurate in some fact scenarios. Many times there would be if we had a situation here where Mr. Mertes just went and took $1.9 million out of Millennium's bank account that was not earmarked for these other agents, that would have been
paid.
Well,
how do we know that those agents were never going to collect?
I don't think that we do know that they were never going to collect. All we know is that Millennium has the burden, and they've never shown that they've paid those agents. And this, according to them, on their sworn proof of loss, started in 2001 and ended in 2017.
They still have that obligation. That obligation is still there.
I don't think so. They have not produced one bit of evidence. If they haven't, in their brief, in this case, for the very first time, they completely change their legal theory, and they say, it's an account payable. But they produced... And this is in the record, I think it's at page 383, I think. They produced, during the course of the claim to Great American, documents showing that the thief, Mr. Mertes, took $1.9 million from their own records, and that satisfied Great American's accountant. Now they're saying, it's an account payable. They never produced any records
At the end of the day, they owed money to these travel agents, and they didn't pay them. And those agents... presumably have a claim against them for monies that they are lawfully entitled to.
If they have a claim, it's up to Millennium to prove that, and Millennium moved for summary judgment. That's why we're here. Millennium had the burden under Rule 56 to prove that they owed that money, and they did not do that.
So that's your defense. This case all turns on their inability to show that they owed, there are proper travel agents who they owed money to that they didn't pay. That's what this case turns on.
In this instance, it turns on the fact that they ended up, from a pecuniary or financial point of view, in the exact same place that they always intended, because for whatever reason they did not pay the legitimate travel agents.
What does always intended mean? I mean, they...
Well, but they've admitted that. There's a stipulation on this appeal that when the legitimate travel agents brought them the customers, that they would pay them a commission.
They never did that.
So now, if we have to pay, then they get all these bookings for free. Where they were going to pay... we gave the example in our brief of $30 for a commission. They were going to pay that. They didn't. Now we're 10, 15 years later. If Your Honor's order that this is a covered loss, they have gotten this big windfall because they got all these free bookings because they never paid the commissions. If they had paid the commissions, we would not be here. And Your Honors might remember that there were two parts of the scheme. In the first part of the scheme, Mr. Mertes changed, some of the reservations were made just directly by the hotel guests with no travel agent. He changed those and put in his own travel agency. In that case, Millennium would have kept the whole, what we said was $300. But because he took it, they only got $270. So we agreed that that would be covered. And that's not part of this appeal. It's only the second part of the scheme where they always expected to earn only the $270, the $300 minus the $30, using our example. They never paid the second $30. Of course, Mertes shouldn't have stolen the money. We're not on his side. But he did, and they still ended up with $270, which is where they were all along. That is not a loss according to the case law.
Okay. Thank you,
Your Honors.
May it please the court. David Ogles on behalf of the Millennium Hotel plaintiffs, appellees. The district court was correct to rule that under the crime protection policy issued by the insurer Great American, Millennium suffered loss as a matter of law. An employee, Murtis, stole more than $1.9 million from Millennium. And as a result, Millennium actually dispersed all of that that money to the thief Murtis. These facts are undisputed. The district court's holding that these facts establish loss is consistent with this court's holding under identical policy language in First Defiance.
What about the issue? So I was talking with your friend on the other side about the payments to the agents that legitimately should have gotten the money. Is there a dispute over whether they should have legitimately gotten the money? Is that a fact issue?
Your Honors, the question is whether the legitimate agent should have been paid.
Well, we talked quite a bit. I mean, my mind, this always turns on this third-party actions, which has a lot of complications, but they say it's your obligation to show that you owed them money and right. that they were paid, so there was an actual loss. So just help me with that range of issues.
Whether or not the legitimate travel, so I guess I'll back up a second, Your Honor. The way that the method worked, at least the one at issue, is that the employee, the thief Murtis, changed the booking entries for rooms that he didn't actually book. A real travel agent did book those rooms. They were owed commissions. The issue before the district court was whether Millennium had suffered loss as a matter of law, whether or not Millennium paid those commissions. So it's not a material fact whether the commissions were actually paid to the legitimate travel agents.
Just a pragmatic question, did the legitimate travel agents ever complain? Didn't they notice that they weren't getting paid?
They did not complain, Your Honor. And in fact, the record before the court,
it just seems like I would notice if I wasn't getting paid for my commissions due, and I would complain. So is there any reason why that happened? I'm just curious.
Millennium would agree completely with that, Your Honor. The only reasonable inference to draw from the lack of complaints is that they were paid. But the partial summary judgment record and the reason why it was filed the way it was is to cut through that fact issue. The Great American disagrees with that. They draw a different inference. The court was simply asked to rule, is it enough for Millennium to show that it actually dispersed the $1.9 million to a thief? The money was stolen. It was never recovered from him. Is that loss as a matter of law? The district court agreed.
So the record before us doesn't show whether those agents were paid or weren't paid?
Correct, Your Honor. That's correct.
What do you, at some point, don't you think it becomes somebody else's property? So I'm trying to figure out what the legal rule should be. And I had the hypothetical of what if you put cash in the mail, sending off to an agent, and somehow the employee knows this and travels to the agent's home or the agent's place and steals it from the mail at the agent's place. Would you say that that is still your loss, or would you say that that has become the agent's loss?
Your Honor, in the situation where the money is already in the possession and in the ownership of the agents, and it's actually stolen from the agents, that would not be a loss by Millennium, because the money would be stolen from the agents. That's the Cooper case that was cited by
the
Great American.
So is that a key question then? Why at the time at the time Mr. Murtis engaged in the fraud, it's undisputed that that was still your property because it was it in just a generic bank account and he just moved the money so the check was sent to him rather than to the actual agent?
That's correct, Your Honor. By changing the booking, it caused a third-party administrator to send the commission payments to him instead of to the legitimate agents.
What do you do with the kind of the key equity argument here on the other side, which is it is kind of true you are getting a windfall because if the actual agents haven't sued, assuming the state of the facts that we have to, which is that they didn't get sued, then that means you didn't pay the amounts that you would have been obligated to pay, and therefore you're getting, in some respects, a double recovery.
Right, Your Honor. And again, we're in that world where we're assuming that the payments were not made to the legitimate agents. Really, all in that situation, all that's happening is restoring Millennium to the status quo ante. Before the theft happened, Millennium had cash and it owed the legitimate agents. After the theft, the cash went away. All Millennium is asking the insurer to do is live up to its end of the bargain, which is to restore the cash to Millennium. We were actually being brought right back to the situation that we were in before the theft, and that's what indemnity is supposed to do. And again, as in First and Defiance, that's consistent with this court's ruling in First Defiance that if property qualifies as covered property and a dishonest employee steals it, the employee directly causes the loss. It is as simple as that. That's the rule that Millennium believes should be applied here.
So your friend on the other side says that our circuit cases didn't really address the loss question. They were focusing on some other things.
That's incorrect, Your Honor. The American Tooling case did hold that there is a direct loss. Direct loss is
The legal reasoning, I suppose, the argument is that the legal reasoning was only about direct and not about what loss means, and therefore we can distinguish it because this case is about what loss means, not about what direct means.
I think the one issue with that, Your Honor, is that that would create an unworkable framework for how to analyze insurance policy, that if direct loss as a matter of law, because remember, in American Tooling, that reversed summary judgment for the insurer and granted it to the insured, and it held that direct loss as a matter of law was established when at the moment of the transfer. And recall that in American Tooling, Your Honor, the argument from the insurer there was that the loss only occurred at the moment when the payments were made to the real vendor. That was the argument. It's indirect, because the thief stole the money, and then only after paying the vendor does the loss occur. This court rejected that argument, said that that reasoning defies common sense, very, very strong language, and says that if I'm as a insured prepared, if I have a dollar bill and I'm prepared to hand it to someone else and a thief comes and snatches it from me, I've suffered a loss, and to say otherwise defies common sense. So I think that it'd be impossible to find that no loss existed while also maintaining the core reasoning of the American Tooling case. Similar also in First Defiance, Your Honor. In that case, this insurer made a similar argument that the reason why there was no direct loss or that the loss wasn't directly resulting was because the loss only occurred after the payments were made. So again, in that case, it was a bank, an employee stole the bank's funds held for other clients. It wasn't even the bank's property, but the policy covered property like this policy, property that was merely held by the insured. And in that case, it was sufficient to find that there was a theft of the funds and the funds were dispersed. The loss didn't occur later after the funds were repaid to the clients. It occurred at the moment of the theft. Because
different question. Was Murdy's prosecuted?
Was Murdy's prosecuted? Yes, Your Honor. He was convicted of larceny.
Did he have to pay restitution, any kind of restitution?
No funds were recovered from Murdy's.
Is that in the record?
I don't know if that's in the record, Your Honor, but it is undisputed that Millennium didn't recover anything from Murdy's. Yeah, he had spent it all. I think the only other thing I would say, Your Honor, is I think opposing counsel mentioned that it was stipulated that there was no payment. That is not correct. There's a stipulation on the record. The only thing that was stipulated was lifted directly from the district court's motion for summary judgment order, and that was that Millennium did in fact pay in disbursements $1.94 million. There's nothing in the record where Millennium has stipulated that it didn't pay the agents. Unless the court has other questions, I think my prepared remarks concluded. Then I think Millennium would ask this court please to affirm the district court's ruling below. Thank you.
Mr. Celebrezze, you have 3 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Counsel just referred to the status quo ante, and that if the judgment of the district court is affirmed, that's where we'll be. Exactly the opposite. The status quo ante would mean that at the time of the theft, the legitimate travel agents had brought this business to Millennium. Millennium would not have had the business under the legitimate scheme but for these agents, these legitimate agents, and they were entitled to be paid. And they were not paid. So what happened was, therefore, as I mentioned, using our hypothetical, or our number, Millennium was expecting to bill $300 for the room. because the legitimate agents had brought the business, they were going to pay them the $30, and therefore they were going to earn, Millennium was going to earn $270. At the end of the day, how much did Millennium earn? $270. Not because the transaction went the way it was supposed to, but because Mertis took the same $30, Millennium still got the benefit of the business and didn't pay.
Let's go back to Judge Murphy's first question, which is a pretty good one, is the limits on your theory, because every money that a company has is going to use for some other reason. So they have $1 million sitting around, and they're going to use that to expand their facility. But an employee steals it, so they don't expand the facility. And in your theory, while they're in the same place, because they didn't actually incur that extra $1 million expense, they were going to lose $1 million anyway, whether it was to the employee or to build the add on to the facility. It's like there's never any money sitting around that's not going to be used for some other reason.
But using Your Honor's example, they were going to use that money to build infrastructure. It wasn't money that they owed to somebody else and didn't have to pay. So, yes, of course, Your Honor's right.
It's money they didn't have to use for another purpose. I would consider that if you lost money that you could have otherwise used for another purpose, that feels like a loss.
I understand what Your Honor is saying, but if I can, I think that Your Honor's scenario will create a much bigger nightmare than what Your Honor is suggesting that I'm arguing, because we are now going to be rewarding everyone who can come up with a scheme that didn't here. I'm not blaming Millennium, but if this opinion comes out and says the minute the money is out the door, end of discussion, that is a loss no matter what, then it doesn't matter. It's just going to invite nothing but windfalls. It's going to invite collusion. We talked about.
Well, isn't there exclusion for collusion?
There's an exclusion that's in most insurance codes for fraud. Well, I don't think that the court wants to be on the side of saying, well, go ahead and collude because the insurance company will catch you on the back end. I don't think that Your Honor would suggest that.
I wasn't. If they do it, they can't recover because you've wisely written that into the policy.
Assuming we can prove it on an exclusion, or it would be our burden. Here, Millennium, the bottom line is Millennium is going to get a windfall. This policy does not provide for windfalls. It's supposed to cover loss, putting people back where they would have been had the theft not occurred. What's going to happen here, what happened at the district court, and if this were to be affirmed, Millennium will not be put back in the position it was in.
I sort of cut you off. Was there any other point you wanted to make?
No, thank you very much, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Case will be submitted.